Welcome. Very excited to have you. This is Tuesday, June 13, 2017. Welcome to the inaugural Slow Art Day live podcast. I'm Phil Terry. I'm the founder of Slow Art Day, and I will introduce our distinguished guest speaker, Professor Arden Reed, in just a moment. But before I do, let me say a few words about Slow Art Day and about this new live podcast series. I originally developed the idea for Slow Art Day in 2008 after spending an hour looking at Hans Hofmann's painting Fantasia. It was hanging in the Jewish Museum in New York as part of a special exhibition called Action Abstraction about the post-war abstract expressionists and the influential rival art critics Clement Greenberg and Harold Rosenberg. The experience of slow looking at one painting for an hour was so powerful, so joyful, and frankly so surprising to me that I decided that in this fast-paced, multitasking world, more people needed to know that experience and to experience the joy of slowing down with art. I ran a series of test sessions at MoMA in New York in 2009. I brought small groups together to look for 5 to 10 minutes at a series of paintings and sculptures. That went so well that I decided to officially launch Slow Art Day in 2010. Originally began by volunteers, mostly outsiders from the art world, mostly my friends in the internet world, we started with events at 60 museums in the United States, Canada, and Europe. I'm happy to say that 7 years later, we now have had thousands of events. By the way, just this year, it seems that something like 60 museums in Poland celebrated Slow Art Day. And today, most of the events are professionally designed by the museums themselves, by the curators and educators. The creativity that museums have brought to designing Slow Art Day sessions is really exciting. There's a growing movement around Slow Art Day and around slow looking and slow creating. As a result of this growing movement, we decided to launch this live podcast series to bring this community together and to learn from professors, artists, educators, curators, journalists, critics, and others. And I can't imagine a better first session than the one we're going to do today with Professor Arden Reed. Just a few logistics issues first. All of our many museum educators, curators, and professors who are on the line live with us today will be muted for about the first 40 minutes or so during Professor Reed's presentation. Questions. While Professor Reed is speaking, please note your questions. You can put them through the GoToWebinar control panel. There's actually a question interface there. Or you can email me, pterry@slowartday.com. We will get to your questions during the Q&A session, and it would be helpful for me to know ahead of time what you're thinking. So please post them on the webinar panel or email me. Future live podcasts. If you would like to propose a topic or speaker, please contact me. We do already have the following sessions organized in addition to today. In July, we have Slow Looking at Art Basel, Hong Kong. On Tuesday, July 18th, we'll speak to BBC journalist Linda Kennedy, who interviewed artists and gallerists in Hong Kong during Art Basel, asking them about Slow Looking and Slow Art Day. She did this completely, by the way, without our knowledge, and when we saw the wonderful segment she produced, we reached out and invited her to come speak to us and share what she learned, including what didn't make it into the segment, and more generally about the art world in Hong Kong and mainland China. On Tuesday, August 22, we will have a session with Annie Storr, visiting scholar at Women's Studies Research Center, Brandeis University, Slow Art Day host, and the creator of what she calls Exercises for the Quiet Eye workshops. She writes a lot about slow looking and the art of that, and I believe Annie is actually on the line with us today. Tuesday, September 12th, we'll have longtime host Christian Adame, and he is Assistant Education Director at the Phoenix Art Museum. He's designed and piloted the Slow Art and Mindfulness Summer Series with PAM this summer. He'll talk about the pilot program and what they learned. He's also live with us today. I also want to say Maggie Friedman is the Volunteer Global Coordinator of Slow Art Day, and among other things, is helping me produce this podcast series. Most of you interact with Maggie, and I just want to thank her again for extraordinary work. Now, I'm really excited to introduce Professor Arden Reed. He is the Arthur and Fanny Doyle Professor of English at Pomona College. He's recipient of fellowships from Guggenheim Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Clark Art Institute. He writes on the visual arts and literature, including Manet, Flaubert, and the Emergence of Modernism, a previous book of his, which I've read and loved, and the prize-winning Romantic Weather, The Climates of Coleridge and Baudelaire. I just want to say a few other things about him and about this book. First of all, he was one of Jacques Derrida's first American graduate students. Trained in comparative literature, he authored a prize-winning study of Coleridge and Baudelaire. His career as a scholar of literature was interrupted in 1984 when he experienced a conversion. I think a little bit like my experience with the Hans Hoffman, he encountered Max Beckmann's triptych, The Actors at the Fog Museum, and he experienced that, and it pivoted his field of study to the visual arts. His book, Manet, Flaubert, and the Emergence of Modernism, has been translated into French and Spanish. His latest book, the one we're excited to be here today, Flow Art, and I'll say more about that in a moment, is forthcoming. It's being published in 2 weeks, and we have a 30% discount code. We'll talk about that in a moment, and there will be a French translation to follow. This book was supported by a Guggenheim Fellowship and residencies at the Rockefeller Foundation Study Center at Bellagio, the Clark Art Institute, and the American Academy in Rome. I want you to know that in addition to with us, we are very honored to have him here today. He's given presentations on slow art at the Russian Academy of Sciences in St. Petersburg, the Metropolitan Museum of Art here in New York, King's College, Cambridge University, the Chicago Humanities Festival, and other places. And look, I just want to say a few more things. This latest book, the focus of our inaugural podcast, is going to be coming out in just 2 weeks. I want all of you to go purchase it. This is a very important book for our movement. And following today's podcast, we'll be emailing you a 30% discount link. The book is Slow Art, The Experience of Looking, Sacred Images to James Turrell, University of California Press. And what is it about? You won't be surprised to know. It's about attending to visual images in a culture of distraction, specifically extending the 6 to 10 seconds that Americans on average spend looking at individual works on museum walls, and why that matters. The book dwells with various media, photography, painting, sculpture, film, fiction, video, digital, and so on, from the present and the past. And it really looks at models, ways to open out acts of looking and make them more meaningful. I've had a chance to read the book, and I'm excited about this today, as you can tell. He's provided a lot of depth to the topic we all care so much about. He brings a multidisciplinary approach. As I said, he began and continues to be an English professor, but has become a visual scholar and thinks about this from multiple perspectives, from the perspective of the spectator, if you will, from the observer, from the artist, and has thought philosophically, aesthetically, from the point of view of an art critic and lover of art and a lover of words and language. And the last thing I'll say is most of you know that in addition to Flow Art Day, I also run the Reading Odyssey, aimed at helping adults develop lifelong reading habits. So today's session and our relationship with Professor Reed works on multiple levels. I'm excited about this book, this talk, and this new podcast series. So thank you, Professor Reed, for helping us launch this and for everything you've done to help us understand something we all love so much. Welcome.
Thank you, Phil. Thank you for inviting me, and especially thank you for starting all of this, having the wit both to realize that such a thing was possible, and then to have the organizational genius to make it work and flourish. And in the book, I talk about the astonishing growth of Slow Art Day, and I think it says something important about the culture. So what I'd like to do in the next half hour or so is to give you a quick pass over slow territory, which is obviously a kind of irony, and doubly ironic, I suppose, because I think that Phil has already touched the highlights. But to begin with, what I'd like to do is consider a few contemporary performances and artworks, and you'll see that all of them are a little offbeat. I want to begin with literature, an excerpt from a 2001 novella by Don DeLillo called The Body Artist. This is a story about a performance artist whose name is Lauren Harkey, and here she is watching a live video feed. I quote, "It was the middle of the night in Kotka, in Finland, and she watched the screen, cars entering and leaving Kotka, or just the empty road in the dead times. The dead times were best. She sat and looked at that screen. It was compelling to her, real enough to withstand the circumstance of nothing going on. to set aside time every day for the webcam at Kotka. It was best in the dead times. It emptied her mind and made her feel the deep silence of other places. And the numbers changed in the digital display with an odd and hollow urgency, the seconds advancing toward the minute, the minutes climbing hourward, and she sat and watched, waiting for a car to take fleeting shape on the roadway. Close quote. Later, DeLillo describes a performance piece of hers in which this video is projected onto the back wall. The reviewer remarks, and I'm quoting again, Arki clearly wanted her audience to feel time go by viscerally, even painfully. This is what happened, causing walkouts among the less committed. They missed the best stuff. Arki then remarks, I know there are people who think the piece was too slow and repetitious, I guess, and uneventful, but it's probably too eventful. It ought to be sparer, even slower than it is, even longer than it is. It ought to be 3 hours. Why not 4? Asks her interviewer. Why not 7? Why not 8? Warren answers and continues. Maybe the idea is to think of time differently. Stop time, or stretch it out, or open it up. Make a still life that's living, not painted. When time stops, so do we. Close quote. So the novel raises questions like this. Why should a hip downtown artist spend hours every day watching Kotka? Why are those dead times best? Why should her performance have been even longer? Why did those who walked out miss the best stuff? Well, Lauren is fictional, but there are many actual drawn-out artistic practices. And so the first image on your screen comes from originally from Hitchcock's movie Psycho, but this is from Douglas Gordon's 24-hour Psycho, in which he took the movie apart frame by frame and stretched it out until it lasted 24 hours. And this was shown at MoMA. And in fact, the installation forms the beginning and the end of another novel by Don DeLillo called Point Omega. Here is an installation shot from a performance called 72-Hour Date, in which an artist on Union Square extended the hour that you would ordinarily spend getting ready for a date to 72 hours as the life of the city went on around her. This picture does not quite do justice to its subject matter. This is an image from Walter De Maria's Lightning Field. It's a grid, 1 mile on one side, a kilometer on the other, and those light uprights that you see are aluminum lightning rods. There are 400 of them total. In order to visit this place, you have to go through the Dia Foundation. You drive to a little town called Quemado in the middle of New Mexico, which is already a pilgrimage. And then somebody from the Dia Foundation drives you another hour to this totally isolated cabin where you're dropped off in the early afternoon. And the next day, somebody from Dia comes to get you again. So you are absolutely isolated. And the magical thing that happens is, as the sun is setting and rising, those aluminum poles catch the light and vibrate and seem to come to life. And of course, the opposite happens at sunrise from sunset. Here, some of you may recognize this, is an overhead shot of a 2010 work by Abramovic called The Artist is Present. For nearly 3 months, 6 days a week, 8 hours a day, she sat silent and unmoving across from a visitor. Her performance became a media phenomenon. So a live feed on MoMA's website recorded close to 800,000 hits. And here are some images from the Laguna Pageant of the Masters. This is a festival that's held for 2 months every summer in Laguna Beach, California, a festival of tableau vivant, which is French for living pictures, and which forms a kind of red thread through my book. So if you've never encountered a tableau vivant, by the end of this half hour, you'll know a lot more about them. But it started out as a parlor game that amused Europeans of leisure from the later 18th century to the mid-19th century. To pass time on long country weekends, guests donned costumes and held poses in imitation of famous artworks. employ more or less elaborate sets. So this is what's called tableau vivant. The festival began in 1932 to sell out crowds over a course of 2 months. So on the left, you can see a tableau being readied, and on the right, you can see the performance itself. The pageant has different themes every year, like going west or on the road or things like that, but each season, the last tableau is one of The Last Supper, and what you're looking at is not Leonardo's fresco, but The Last Supper itself.
You know, Professor Reed, I grew up in Southern California, I think we talked about that, and I grew up going to this, to the tableau vivant at the Pageant of Masters.
Now I understand exactly how you started slow arting. We're planning each clearly.
Yeah.
Okay. What I'm showing you now is a clip from work by Sam Taylor Johnson. She was known as Sam Taylor Wood, called The Last Century. This video clip lasts for 7 minutes and 12 seconds, but I'm going to let you see about 30 seconds of it, because this will give you who are participating in the webinar a chance to experience a time-based, drawn-out performance, something like Lauren's performance in DeLillo's novel. So I'm going to be quiet for a little bit as we watch nothing much going on. We'll come back to this video a little later, but I want to move on to some other examples of these sort of strange aesthetic events and objects. This is an installation shot from a show that David Zwirner did in his New York gallery in 2013 of black paintings by the American artist Ad Reinhardt. Many of you will be familiar with these. They are all identical in format, 5 foot square, and in this image they all look like the same black square, which they also would if you looked at them briefly in the gallery. It's only if you stand in front of them for a protracted period of time, and I'm not talking 10 seconds or 30 seconds, I'm talking several minutes. Eventually those black squares resolve themselves into checkerboards, 9 square checkerboards with slight color variations that make up the painting, and each one of these has a slightly different formula. But unless you're willing to spend time with them, they look simply like what you see in the slide. Here is another video. This was from a live broadcast made in 2009 of a 7-hour train trip from Oslo to Bergen in Norway by that country's public television station. This became also a kind of media phenomenon, with a good 20% of the country's population tuned in to watch. Another example from a different medium would be John Cage's ASAP, capital letters, which stand for As Slow As Possible. This is a composition being performed at a church. Even now, it's being performed at a church in Halberstadt, a little town in Germany. The performance began in 2001 and is scheduled to have a duration of 639 years, ending in the year 2640. And finally, here is a slide of James Turrell's Skyspace at PS1. If you haven't been in a sky space, imagine a room. It can be square, it can be round, it can be oblong, with benches ranged around the walls of the room and an oculus overhead open to the sky. So the question that arises is, why would people keep looking at a patch of sky as if it were a painting? Okay, if you take these various examples and hold them together, questions arise. First of all, are these similarities simply coincidental? Are they a fluke? And then, unless these artists are simply sadistic or perverse, why do they make such demanding works? The LA artist Ed Ruscha has a definition of good art that I think helps answer that question. Somebody once asked Ruscha, how can you tell the difference between a good work of art and a bad? And Ruscha had a wonderful answer. He said, with a bad work of art, you look at it and immediately say, wow, but you hang around a little bit, and after a while you think, maybe not. With a good work, Ruscha says, the opposite happens. In other words, good art only reveals itself over time. But against that fact, consider that, as Phil said, the average American spends between 6 and 10 seconds looking at individual artworks. So it's no wonder that museum educators report lots of visitor dissatisfaction, observing that their clientele often feel disheartened, even though more Americans visit art museums annually than attend all major league sporting events and theme parks combined.
That's a great statistic. I didn't know that. I'm very happy to hear that.
Astonishing statistic.
Yeah.
So if the similarities among the examples that I gave you, if they're not coincidental, do they point to a new aesthetic field? Do they help populate that field, a field that we could call slow art? And if so, how do we delineate that field? I thought at first when my partner gave me the title slow art, I thought, well, this will be pretty easy to understand. And it ended up taking me many years to work out the implications. So the adjective slow in the title, I think, is well earned. One of the issues was that my definition would need to be neither so tight that it excluded relevant work. And as Phil said, I wanted to include works from the past and the present, from high art and popular art, and so on. But nor could my definition be so loose as to lack distinctiveness. In other words, what I wanted to call slow art had to be instantly recognizable as such, an experience that all of us could easily name. So after lots of cogitating, here's what I came up with. Slow art is not a collection of objects. My first thought was slow art must be exactly that. But I came to understand that rather, slow art is a set of experiences. It is exactly what transpires between the viewer and the object viewed. So here is a wonderful Thomas Struth photograph of an old man looking at a Rembrandt portrait of an old man. And slow art, as I understand it, is exactly what happens in the space between those two men's heads. Here is a still from a wonderful video that I just ran across in Washington, D.C. a couple of weeks ago by Reineke Diestra. This is a bunch of English school children, and the camera is placed where the painting that they're looking at is, and what they're viewing one of Picasso's Weeping Women, and there's a long dialogue in which the kids are trying to come to terms with what they're seeing. Who is this woman? Why is she so sad? And they start making up stories about what might have made her sad. And it's sort of wonderfully funny and touching, but it's also a perfect example of the experience of slow art. Let's see here. So, slow art is something that happens when you bring the observer together with the object viewed. So a couple of caveats. First about slowness. Slowness is a relative experience. You can't understand slowness without having also in your memory an experience of speed. One only makes sense in terms of the other. And the book is a lot about the interdependence of slowness and speed. So if you noticed in that video taken in the English pub, even though the characters are not moving, you can see flashes of traffic or pedestrians passing by outside. And that, for me, is a nice example of how slowness and speed englobe each other. Another caveat, and this is that I'm not saying that slowness is an unqualified good, nor is speed necessarily bad. Obviously, I want a quick internet connection as much as you do. I'm also not proposing that beholders simply hunker down before artworks in focus. Ironically, even though at first I thought that was the case, I think that if I tell somebody, now, stare at this painting for 10 minutes, it's an instant invitation to fidgeting and not to look at your watch, not to look at the painting, but to look at your watch instead. And then it's not that any kind of slowness will do. There are different varieties of slowness. For me, slowness must be earned. In other words, a slow work must repay the time that it asks of us. And finally, your slow art doesn't have to be mine. What matters is that we have a category to deploy. Okay, so to summarize, slow art names an encounter rather than things. It would follow then that either the observer or the object can spark that experience. So let's take them one at a time. What happens when the observer initiates a slow art experience? This simply means when we pause long enough for the artwork to begin to have its effect on us. Another character in Don DeLillo says, "I could look at paintings till I drop." The 19th century French novelist Gustave Flaubert observed, and Phil, you'll like this, anything becomes interesting if you look at it long enough. Anything becomes interesting if you look at it long enough.
Yeah.
Observer can initiate the slow art experience, but so can the object. The Enlightenment philosopher Diderot said that the successful artwork does three things. It calls to us from afar, it stops us in our tracks, and then it holds us. Now, I think the object can work in complementary ways. A stationary object can gradually take on movement, or a moving object can decelerate until it almost stops. What you're looking at now is a detail from a monochrome painting by Joe Marioni, a New York artist. And I think the wonderful thing about Marioni's painting, and in fact, there's a red painting on the cover of the book. What intrigues me about it is those little drips at the bottom of the canvas, which are sort of Marioni's signature, what distinguishes his monochrome paintings from those by other monochrome artists. So if you look at those drips, they seem to be held in suspension. And you could imagine two things happening. You could imagine the paint gradually coming down the canvas, pulled by gravity, until either it coagulates and stops right there, or you could imagine those drips gathering momentum and materiality until they're about to drip down to the floor. But either way, the drip is held in suspension. And you can think of those drips as a kind of emblem of slow art. In other words, the objects that spark slow art are hinged between stillness and motion. They partake of both. You could think of them as pivoting either toward freezing or towards flowing. And just so, for observers, the beholder's motion through the gallery is suspended. And so I decided that suspension makes a fine emblem for slow art. Mm-hmm. Here is an 18th century painting called The Game of Knuckle Bones by the French painter Chardin. He captures in this painting a moment when a girl is contemplating a little object that she's tossed in the air as it reaches its apogee. This instant fixes her attention. She is absorbed because in order to catch the object, she'll need to imagine its descending arc. As she is absorbed, so the viewer, we in turn become absorbed in her state of mind. We put ourselves in her shoes. Visual suspense can also take non-figurative forms. Here is Richard Serra's delineator, which is made of two metal plates, and you can't quite get the dimensions from the slide, but each is 10 by 26 feet. One plate rests on the floor. Its twin is attached to the ceiling, hung at right angles. In other words, what Serra has done is to show us a holdup. The sculpture is raised spatially, but also temporally. It creates a kind of force field of suspense. And when you're standing under it, you can't help but imagine the top plate crashing down on you and making a sandwich of you. But I've gotten ahead of myself. What I want to do now is to back up and to ask, how in the world did I end up writing on slow art? More so because, as Phil suggested, I'm trained in comparative literature. In fact, I never took a class in art history. And I didn't set out to study slow art. Rather, the book grew out of a series of encounters with artworks that I couldn't have predicted in advance, like the Richard Serra, like the Sam Taylor Johnson, like the Laguna Pageant. But in retrospect, these encounters proved to be fruitful. And as I said, I tried to figure out if there was a commonality among them, if they said something about our culture at this moment, and if so, how to understand that. Well, here, also as Phil suggested, is how it all started. In the fall of 1984, accompanied by some friends, I went to see this Max Beckmann triptych called Actors, that's at Harvard. And I had a kind of epiphany, because what I realized was, as I looked for a prolonged period with my friends, I saw that this triptych had the same kind of intellectual complexity that texts that I was familiar with and thought were the last word in complexity, like a paragraph from Kant or a paragraph from Joyce. I saw that this triptych posed as many intellectual questions as those kinds of texts, but it also did something else. If I'm reading Joyce or Kant, it doesn't much matter whether it's a paperback edition or a fine leather-bound edition. But this painting had a physical quality that those texts lacked. First of all, it's enormous. You have to relate to it with your whole body. But besides scale, there's color, there's texture, there's brush strokes, and then all the weird things that are going on. Who is this king? Why does he seem to be stabbing himself? What's that prostitute doing halfway underneath the stage? How do the three images relate to each other? And so on. And it was genuinely an epiphany for me, although I couldn't have known at the time. But as Phil suggested, it began a reorientation of my whole professional life. That reorientation was reinforced by encountering, and again, it was by chance, this painting by Edouard Manet called Young Lady in 1866. It lives in the Metropolitan Museum. And now I'm going to sound like a crazy person, because I that I spent about 8 years dwelling with this one painting, either in person when I would visit New York or more often in my imagination. You might think that this is a painting that justifies no more than 6 to 10 seconds, especially when you have a lot you want to see. It seems quite straightforward, one woman, one parrot, one pink peignoir, one piece of fruit at the bottom of the parrot's dish. But in fact, the more I looked at it, the more intrigued I became and the more questions the painting raised, until I finally decided that it's about the mystery of the visible. Well, you could call this...
Say that last part again, because it broke up for a second. You finally decided it was...
This is a mysterious painting, but the mystery lies on the surface. It's the mystery of what we see, not the mystery of what's hidden. Okay?
Yeah.
So you could say that spending 8 years looking at one damn painting is an act of self-indulgence. And yes, it's the kind of luxury that comes with having tenure. But my defense, if I feel I need to defend myself, which I always do, my defense is that two books came out of it. First, the one that Phil mentioned, a book about Manet, Flaubert, and the emergence of modernism. And the second is this new book called Slow Art. And in Slow Art, I try to ask what's valuable about this bizarre experience I had for people with less time on their hands. Well, from the outset, I knew that the book needed to reflect the pleasure and passion that I took in the experience of looking at Beckmann or Manet, or Phil's looking at Hans Hofmann. So I knew that the book needed to be not a detached scholarly account, which was the character of all the other books I had written. I knew that slow art had to define a new field, but it had to do more than define a new field. It had to reflect my own experience. And so the book ended up making an ethical claim, and this is maybe the most important thing about it. So I propose that slow art is good both for the object and for the observer. Slow art benefits both the object and the observer. What I mean by that, let's take one at a time. First the object and then the observer. Why would slow art be good for artworks? Well, I think that every genuine painting works like an Ad Reinhardt. In other words, we see pretty much nothing at all if we only give it 6 to 10 seconds. This maybe is what Ed Ruscha meant by art worth its salt. In other words, I think that looking at paintings is every bit as much a time-based experience as watching a film or listening to music. And if you think about painting and music and film, you'll see a kind of similarity that's not immediately apparent, because I think that listening to music can offer a model, actually, for looking at paintings, because both of them unfold over time, even though that's not the way we ordinarily think about paintings. But the great art historian Ernst Gombrich makes the case. I'm going to quote him. The reading of a picture needs a very long time. When we look at a picture, we build it up in time and hold the bits and pieces we scan in readiness till they fall into place as an imaginable object. Both in hearing a melody and in seeing an image, the effort after meaning leads to a scanning backward and forward in time and in space, which alone gives coherence to the image. In other words, like a musical score, slow art has to be performed. It has to unfold over time. We have to scan backwards and forwards in time and space. And so, and this is one of the book's mantras, slow art transforms the painting into a moving picture. That's how much things change as you dwell with the painting. And that's why Reinhardt is such a beautiful example. So what do I conclude from this? I think that, quoting DeLillo's performance artist, by stretching out time or opening it up, art can teach us how to look at art. That's, after all, what Slow Art Day is about. Art can teach us the composure we need to look at art, and slowing down for one art help us slow down for others. So we build up a catalog of experiences, and if you attend Slow Art Day year after year, you're going to have that kind of backlog. One experience will ricochet and recall others. Okay, so that's why I say slow art is good for the artwork, but it's also good for us viewers. To understand why, I need a brief detour into history. And as you're looking at the Manet painting, I hope that you're imagining some of the questions that the painting might raise, but I'm not going to detour into that now. One detour at a time is enough. But when I started working on this book, I thought that slow art is a timeless phenomenon, because in principle, you can look at anything for a long time or look at it longingly. But I gradually came to understand that art is, in fact, a product of modernity. It began when two massive cultural forces in the late 18th century converged, and ever since then, those forces have only grown more acute. The first of those two forces is acceleration, and the illustration is from a stereo card that I found in Paris in the Bibliothèque Nationale, Cours de Philosophie d'Enfer. This is a kind of jokey plaster cast of devils in hell on their bicycles. This in the 1850s would have been considered speed, but speed associated with something devilish, both dangerous and seductive. So acceleration. Capitalism and advances in technology like the Industrial Revolution quickened the pace of everyday life in unprecedented ways. People experienced time speeding up. And the pressures of acceleration, in turn, created the need for psychological breathers or times out. People felt life passing too fast and needed some way to put on the brakes. But that first force is acceleration. But at the same time, we have secularization. This is a slide of the goddess of reason placed on the altar of Notre Dame. And it is the cult of reason that takes the place of Christianity. The philosopher Hegel testified to how Western society was growing increasingly secularized in the wake of the Enlightenment. He said, "No matter how we see God the Father, Christ, and Mary so estimably and perfectly portrayed, it is no help. We bow the knee no longer before these artworks." As a result, occasions to slow one's tempo became harder to access, like devotional practices requiring viewers to focus intensely on a single work over long periods of time. So what happens when you put acceleration and secularization together? What happens is that an increased need meets decreased opportunities to address that need. To think of it this way, on the Autobahn of modernity, everybody needs off-ramps, but the old rest stop closed. So maybe you see where I'm going. The confluence of these two developments opened new spaces, new opportunities for new experiences. And so, and this is probably the key to the book, I think that as culture sped up and as sacred viewing practices waned, slow art came along to offer, to satisfy our need for downtime. It did so by creating social spaces that require sustained attention simply in order to have those experiences. So you could think of slow art not as replacing, but as displacing extended viewing practices in ages of faith. Two examples will show you what I mean. This was another chance encounter. In 2012, I happened on Warhol's great double pink Last Supper made in 1986. They were on display temporarily in the nave of a 15th century Amsterdam church. And I won't go into details, but I can tell you that experiencing this diptych in that church was a radically different encounter than seeing the Warhol would have been in a New York White Cube gallery. I'm going to skip the next one. Mine is not a factual position. Most art writers would find my argument retrograde, given the long struggle to free art from its bondage to religion. That's, after all, partly what the Enlightenment was about. It meant that henceforth artists and patrons were free to choose secular subjects. The current art orthodoxy holds that museums should not be modern cathedrals, that we should cut all those transcendental ties. As Frank Stella famously said, what you see is what you see, leaving no room for mystery. But that's where I want to apply the brakes. I want to know, what do you see when you see? And I think it's not so cut and dried. So in response to the current orthodoxy, I point back to artworks that I listed at the outset. How to account for Abramovich's crowds or the Norway TV watchers. Mark Taylor, who teaches the history of religion at Columbia, put it this way. There is a palpable anxiety afoot today that I have never before experienced. We no longer know what to believe or whom to trust. He wrote this, by the way, before the Trump era. At such a moment, perhaps art can create an opening that is the space of hope. Now, I'm not saying that art needs to be our new religion, and certainly we don't need to resort to spiritual claims for slow art. It's enough to address those reports of widespread museum visitor dissatisfaction. I am a resolute populist, and hence my affinity for Slow Art Day. I believe that everybody who enters a museum is entitled to have meaningful experiences. More, I believe, everybody is already enabled to do so. You don't need Art History 101. You don't need technical
technology. Right.
You don't need an app or a video guide. You don't need to have taken a drawing class, even though all those may help. All you really need, I tell my students, is your 18 plus years of using your eyes along with your life experience. That suffices to have the kind of encounters that literally changed my life. Of course, alongside believing in your rights and abilities, you need practice. And doubtless there are many ways to do that. What works for me is largely pretty simple. First, trust that your eyes will lead you to something interesting, if not in the first gallery, then in the second or third. Rather than listening to authorities, trust your taste. And second, and no surprise, simply slowing down. Know that less really is more. The 10 minutes spent with one artwork is worth more than 15 seconds spent on. His problem is how to decelerate in the age of the internet. Well, all of this, of course, is about time, because time is not just my subject, but it's also my master. And I was going to say something more about the Laguna Pageant of the Masters and the importance of tableau vivant, but I'm also looking at my clock, and I'm thinking that it's gone on too long, and we should open up the webinar. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. This is terrific. Thank you so much. And there's so much I want to say. I'd like to begin by asking one of the participants, Dana Marie Lemmer, who is the director and curator of the Wiregraph Museum of Art in Dothan, Alabama, and who was one of the key global, you know, volunteers that really got Slow Art Day off the ground and did an enormous amount of work over the years. Dana, I want to make sure, hopefully this will work. If you do star 2 on your phone, I think it will unmute you and allow you to join us live here. Can you do that now? Star 2. Let's bring you in. Yeah. Okay. Maybe that's not working. Maggie, if you'll go into the controls for the webinar and just unmute everyone, that would be great. And if for those of you who can hear me, you can post a question. Right. Okay. So, right, it said it could not be unmuted. All right. I think we're now all unmuted. Dana, can you?
Hello.
Welcome, Dana.
Hello.
Dana, meet Professor Reed.
Dana.
Hi. What a wonderful presentation. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with everyone.
The opportunity.
Dana, do you want to say a little? I know you said you love the example of Sam Taylor Johnson's film work.
Oh, I did. Yeah, no, I thought that was a nice surprise. I was first familiar with her work, actually an exhibition that MoCA Jacksonville did several years ago around the concept of slow looking and slow practice. So that was nice to see. I really loved what you talked about as far as the collective experiences that, you know, these things build over time. But I'm curious if in your research you have seen any examples or have any observations of how these ideas from Slow Art Day translate into non-arts related industries.
That's interesting. Well, Vienna Wine. An educator started something called visual thinking strategies.
Mm-hmm.
And what he claims is that the experience of protracted and concentrated looking can have effects all across the spectrum of learning, not just looking at images, but also reading texts, but even sociology or math, anything that sustained concentration. And he's mm-hmm. demonstrated this visual thinking strategy in hundreds of schools from kindergarten through 12th grade.
Wow. Sorry, there's a little sound because we unmuted it, but I think we can all hear what you're saying, so keep going. if you have background noise, if you would mute your phone locally there, because it's a little distracting. Sorry about that. But Dana, you heard what Professor Reed was saying about, and I'm guessing you might be familiar with visual thinking strategies.
I have, yes. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah. Great. Well, there are a number of things I'd like to say, and then I want to hear from others, because we have people who are calling in from Europe who, you know, are in museums and education and curation there, as well as across the United States, and would love to hear more voices. But Professor Reed, you know, several things that I'd like to explore with you. One is there's an interesting tension between the notion that I think you would say that that, as you said, that flow art is earned both by the object and the viewer, and that sort of that concept, and that not every piece of art necessarily is deserving of this. And at the same time, anything you look at for a long time becomes interesting. And I was, you know, and that's, you know, so I, you know, people will often say to me, you know, at different museums, on which art should we select? And my position has been, I don't want to tell you, you go ahead and select it. But I think you've done some interesting thinking about this. But I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, do you see a tension there, and you know, between anything you look at as interesting and only certain pieces really deserve it or earn it? And if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure, that's something that I think a whole lot about. You're right to use the word tension. I think it's a productive tension, and it's what makes the experience of slow art open-ended, because it really does work both ways. But just to focus in on people's experience going through museums, again, I've seen it happen so often.
Hey, Maggie, I tell you what, why don't you go ahead and mute everyone again, just so we have better sound quality. Going through a museum, yeah.
My suspicion is that you could walk into a museum and arbitrarily stop at just about any object. And if Flaubert is right, if you give it enough time, you'll start to find interesting things in it. At the other extreme, you can walk into a gallery like the Beckmann and just be overwhelmed by the fact that it's not as though you had some choice in the matter. It just literally zings you and stops you in your tracks so that you're not thinking about moving on to the next object. It simply has the power to hold you there. But eventually, I think there's got to be some mix. There's something in the object that sustains your attention, but also that the object works on you in such a way that you get out of your ordinary speed culture tempos. You hook into a different temporal experience.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And Bethany O'Connell wrote in over the interface a question, and I'm not sure which museum she's at. It doesn't tell me here, but she was wondering if you have any suggestions for how museums can help integrate this idea into, in particular, communications with museum goers, is at least her question. And so I don't know. I'm assuming, Bethany, you're also thinking about the actual design of the of exhibitions, but I know you're, so feel free to add more to your question here in the interface, but let's start in terms of what you're saying there in terms of communications with museum goers. I don't know if part of what she's asking, one of the things, Arden, that I struggle with is that, you know, if you tell someone, hey, come look at a piece of, come with me, we're going to look slowly, you know, it's not exactly like an exciting marketing message for a number of people. They're like, what? That sounds boring. And then when they have the experience, more often than not, their mind is blown. And in fact, you mentioned, low customer satisfaction or whatever from museum goers. We've done a number of surveys over the years, and the results are like off the charts. Like, people are on fire. So I don't know if you've thought about like that interesting tension, that this is an experience, as you've talked about. It's experiential. It's an encounter. But how, do you have thoughts about how to market that or communicate that in a way that will help attract more people?
Let me say a couple things. First, in terms of museum design, if you think back to the old Whitney, now the lawyer, on the top floor, certain junior curators were given a wonderful assignment: pick one object and put it in a room alone. I don't know if any of you remember that, but it was pretty amazing. Yeah. There were five or six different rooms, and you could occupy any one for as long as you like, but there were absolutely no distractions. And the effect was surprisingly powerful. What's related, and that's the other thing that I wanted to say, is you have to leave people free to come and go. So when I talked about my relationship with that Monet painting of the young woman, I said that I wasn't married to her, but rather I had an affair. I would come and go. I would leave. And it really was largely those times away that enhanced the experience. And so, it comes down to a delicate balance. You want to be able to discipline yourself enough to stick with the object, but you also want to be able to wander around and come back.
Yeah.
Not only come back literally, but come back in your memory. I had a conversation with Richard Serra about this, and he said for him, the test of a great artwork isn't simply your experience while you're there, but the way that it haunts you when you're away. And then you come back to it, and of course, you're experiencing something different from what you experienced seeing it the first time. There are always things that you've missed, which is another reason why a painting is like a moving picture. It's impossible to rock everything at once.
Yeah, that's really great. And I've got there's a by the way, Bethany is with the Missoula Art Museum, and thank you, Bethany, for your question. And Rita Patel has been sharing some stuff here that I thought I would share with you. She just finished a pilot project at the Detroit Institute of Art that involves slow looking as a way to have a personal experience with an art piece. She writes, she describes it as a conversation partner, and she selected positive, let me see if I can read this correctly. She selected positive qualities that can lead to changes in viewpoint, states of mind, and experience of time. It was part of a wellness program focused on caring for the staff, interestingly, of the museum, and they're now in the process of adapting it for the public. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that. It sounds great. I certainly would like to learn more about it. And Rita said one of the things they did was really looked at creating a stepped experience and a kind of a loose directive. I feel like this is just exploding. And you showed the video from Norway, right? I don't know if you saw on our website, but again, they did this completely on their own. The Norwegian Public Broadcasting Service, in collaboration with the National Ballet, did a slow piece of a ballet dancer for Slow Art Day, a film that they put up on the web, which was just stunningly gorgeous. What I'm feeling so excited about is that after about a decade of doing this, and you've been doing it, when did you, 1984, but also when did you start with the Monet at the Met? Was that around 2000? So has it been kind of a 17-year experience for you, if I remember that correctly?
Longer than I want to count.
And I feel like, you know, so we, you know, you've been doing this years longer than we've been doing it, and you're, you know, it's just so helpful the way you think about this. And I'm also, I think the historical context and the kind of collision of acceleration brought by capitalism and secularization, I mean, it, that's such a helpful way to think about this, why slow, you know, where this comes from. I really am, you know, I think that's such an important contribution to our understanding of this. I'm excited to have more of our hosts read your book. And Arden, one thing I would love to suggest, we're kind of close, you know, we're just a little past the hour here, but if we could spend just a few more moments, I'd actually like to propose that we consider some slow reading of your book. And I would like to invite you to consider coming back, if you're open to this, like a year from now, and kind of discuss with those of us who have been reading it kind of more questions and things that have come up as we have, you know, more spent more time with that, with this important work.
That would be my pleasure. And can I just one thing and it really is just to say in different words what we've been talking about.
Yeah.
The motivation behind all of this was that one day that I quite by chance happened on this Beckmann triptych, and it was really for me, and you've talked about this yourself, it really was a revelation. It's a kind of pleasure that no one had ever told me about before, and that if somebody had, probably wouldn't have believed it. I had to experience myself, and having had that experience, I needed to share it. It's partly what I do as a teacher, but it was more than that. It was so compelling to me that I couldn't just keep it to myself.
Yeah. We shared that. I mean, that's exactly how I felt. I mean, you know, I don't necessarily want to use religious language like you were saying earlier, but I mean, when I was at that at the Jewish Museum, I was looking at Hans Hofmann's Fantasia, and by the way, it was not. I mean, I was looking at it, but it was also in context of Gorky and Pollock and de Kooning, and this, you know, like it was the way it was, and it was a Saturday, which the museum is open. Many people don't realize it because of Shabbat, and it's open and free, and literally nobody walked by. I could imagine as if I were in my own living room with these incredible artworks, and you know what I saw 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 40 minutes into the painting, into the looking experience, just blew me away. I couldn't, you know, so much more revealed itself and an experience and a conversation, and I felt exactly that. I didn't know. No one told me. And I need to share this. But as you say, like, you know, it's, you know, so I wanted to design an experiential movement, which I think we've done, and it's exciting to what I think might be the answer to the marketing dilemma that we face is that the world is changing around us. And it feels like more and more this impact of acceleration and secularization maybe is creating, you know, openings for more people to say, what, you know, maybe there's something here. it does feel different than it did, though, 10 years ago, I'll tell you that. The explosion of the creativity of all, you know, and to have Linda Kennedy at the BBC on her own go to Art Basel and interview people there about this. You know, we had never been able to intersect with kind of the festival circuit, and then, you know, the Norwegian broadcasters, and of course the work that you're doing and have been doing predating this, what we've been doing, it's such an important contribution, Art. And I want to thank you for not only this time with us today, for sure, and helping us kick off our live podcast series, but also, most importantly, for this incredible contribution you've made. You know, I look forward to us really, you know, spending some slow time with your book. I want to remind everyone that there's a 30% discount available. We're going to be emailing you a link where you can buy it, and please do. It comes out in 2 weeks, and we'll be talking more about this book, and I would like to actually establish kind of a a discussion group, and we'll invite Professor Reed back to answer our questions and help us deepen our understanding of what I think is a really important book and an important movement. So, thank you, sir.
You are very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Okay. And thank you, everyone, for calling in and being a part of this. And we'll talk to you soon. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.